Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. The US Open starts here, and I say that because you find myself, Catherine Whittaker, and Matt Roberts, as planned, at Heathrow Airport. We've made it this far, Matt. I won't say what could go wrong again, but so far, barring a little bit of intermittent Wi-Fi, it's all gone really quite smoothly. And also, of course, apart from the fact that we were up at 1:30 a.m. watching Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz do ridiculous things, depriving us of sleep. But apart from that, all very smooth.
Maybe too well it's gone so far that we're now worried about Wi-Fi and connection. But so far, we're okay. We've got David on the screen. And yeah, we are pretty tired because of Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz deciding to play the longest Cincinnati final of all time when sleep was precious last night. But it was great, so I don't want to start this podcast by complaining.
We have had about the amount of sleep that David gets every night. This is what it feels
David
like to be
totally
to be you, David.
I feel great. I was in the seat just 6 short hours ago, and I kept trying to think, I really should go to the living room and try and, you know, get it on the big screen, you know, but I'm sort of simultaneously working and watching, and I can't move. I might miss one point, and I just decided to stay where I was for about 4 straight hours, and then I realised I couldn't really get up properly at my advancing years, and but it was all worth it. What a night of tennis! What a day of tennis! The whole thing.
Yeah, Novak Djokovic, the champion in Cincinnati after the most exhilarating tennis match. Certainly the most exhilarating best of three set men's tennis match that I can remember watching, with a completely unique and bizarre narrative and trajectory because, pre-match, we were all expecting something exhilarating and scintillating. But after, it quickly became apparent that it wasn't, or we thought it wasn't going to be the match that we were all expecting, right? After an hour, it was talk of damp squib was rife. There was, you just would not have credited.
Crap, if you like.
Who said crap?
We've said that before about this match.
if you'd been shown a crystal ball and looked into the future and what that match ended up becoming, you wouldn't have believed it. The only person in the world that thought that the scenario that ended up transpiring was possible was Novak Djokovic. Even when he was sat there at a set and a breakdown, having his oxygen saturation measured on the court with a huge ice towel hung around his neck, looking dazed and confused and not just red in the face, kind of purple in the face. I never find Novak Djokovic more relatable than when he's struggling in heat and humidity, because that's how I feel in those sorts of conditions. I get that kind of panicky, claustrophobic sensation where I'm struggling to get air in and struggling to see straight. But even in those moments, I felt like, and I know it's easy to say this in retrospect, but I feel like Djokovic could see this route to the finish line that we all thought was impossible.
Interesting thought that, because, and I think it's one of his many great achievements over the years, is learning how to find a way to come through those moments, because it's not like he stopped struggling in the heat. He was as uncomfortable yesterday as he was when he was retiring from a lot of matches in his early career because of heat related incidents, and he's just figured out ways to sort of ride it out. I mean, sometimes I think he maybe extends the break off the court that he takes, or he just calms his breathing down, or whatever happens. And he's kind of, he is demonstrative. Some people don't like that. Some people don't like the fact that he shows he's hurting and he's uncomfortable. I think it's his way of dealing with it. Is it's like talking therapy for somebody who's struggling with their mental health. His way of coming through those moments of crisis is to let everybody know how awful this is, and it is awful. It's horrible, like you say, Catherine. And I do think that Alcaraz took his eye off the ball a little bit, because he assumed he was going to win. He assumed it was a damp squib as well, because I'm feeling great. I'm 20 years old. I could do this for 3 hours. And he was feeling fine, and he was totally dominating the match. And just incrementally, that's where the 36 years of age and the experience of Djokovic actually ends up helping him. There are downsides, but that ends up helping him.
The thing is, what happens when you have a medical timeout and a physical situation that extreme is that all the intensity gets sucked out of the match. It almost gets awkward and flat, and the whole atmosphere on the court changes. And Alcaraz is thinking, well, everything's been going my way. I'm a set and a break up. I don't want anything to change. And suddenly everything feels different. So that changes everything for Carlos Alcaraz. And yes, I don't think he dealt with that brilliantly, but I do understand it. I do understand how he wasn't able to just keep going the way he was before, because he was playing on a different playing field at that point.
Yeah. And there was maybe even a moment in the Wimbledon final which was similar. You know, it felt like Djokovic was really struggling at the start of that fourth set in that Wimbledon final, and maybe Alcaraz could try and close it out there and then. And he sort of let Djokovic a little bit back into that match, and I think he led him back into this one. And it was just fascinating to see Djokovic sort of feeling like that and going with the ebbs and flows of the match in a best of three. You know, I associate that so much with Djokovic over best of five, but having to do it over best of three in those conditions was maybe a little bit new. And he said afterwards, Djokovic, that it felt like a Grand Slam final, that it was one of the toughest matches he's ever played in his life. And I think almost the biggest sort of compliment you can give Carlos Alcaraz is that the celebration that Djokovic did after the match was the exact same one that he did after that incredible Australian Open final with Rafa Nadal in 2012, where they needed seats during the ceremony because they'd been playing for 6 hours, in that he fell on his back and then he ripped his shirt open. And that 2012 Australian Open, for me, is like the defining Djokovic win, really, in terms of how tough you have to be to try and beat him. And off the back of his breakthrough in 2011, it was like, okay, well, can he back it up? Can he do it again? And he did. And you had this incredible moment where I was like, okay, Djokovic is the guy now. And he's still the guy 10, 11 years later. And he knows that he has to go to those same extremes that he had to all those years ago to get past Rafa Nadal. He now has to do that to try and get past Carlos Alcaraz as well. And I've not seen him that motivated in a Masters event for so long. It felt like, okay, the US Open is a big deal. but that's coming. Right now my focus is this, and I'm this rivalry and trying to get past Alcaraz, and I'm just all in on this, on this sort of intergenerational rivalry that we've got. And there's this premium on all their matches now because it's such a short window that we get to enjoy them, and I think they both know that, and everything's heightened. And yeah, I'm rambling, but I'm just so into these two playing each other.
Yeah, and Djokovic is so grateful for it, isn't it? Because to do what he's doing at this age, motivation is absolutely everything. And I get the impression, especially now the calendar slam is off, almost Alcaraz is the motivation, just keeping him at bay for as long as possible. When, David, was the last time you saw Djokovic willing to go to those kind of dark places in a non-Grand Slam event? I'm trying to remember. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I mean, he's rarely been pushed like that when he's playing well, apart from, I guess, by Nadal most of the time. It would be in those situations. Go back a decade, there were matches, I suppose, like that, and they mattered more because he hadn't... I mean, this was his 39th Blumming Masters 1000 win. That is one of the stats that I really kind of hadn't processed until they announced it at the end of the match. What is that? But I think that's true, because I do feel like at this level, sometimes he's maybe gone behind and he's put a lot in, he's gone behind, and then just that subconscious edge goes off the match because it's not a Grand Slam. He would dig in and find something extra at a Grand Slam that he wouldn't. And I find that understandable. But this guy has brought it out of him. And I do find that very interesting mentally. I enjoyed his slightly delirious interview at the end of the match, Djokovic, where he was so honest about what it meant to him. He's not trying to hide that. He didn't hide it after he lost to Alcaraz either at Wimbledon, about how good he is. You know, he's not trying to paper over it. He knows that this guy is the best of them all. He's got bits of them all, and it's like, and can I find a way to beat that? Oh, I want to beat
I think he's proud. Yeah. I think he's proud that he's hanging with him and getting victories over him, even if he's not beating him every time. He's like, this kid is 20 years old and ridiculous. He's like, you can all see this, right? You can see how good he is. I'm 36. I've seen off Nadal. I've seen off Federer. I've seen off one of Andy Murray's hips. And I'm still fending them off. Just about.
Yeah. And we did wonder on our final Wimbledon show, we had that conversation, what will this do to Novak Djokovic? And I think we all leaned on the side of it will probably motivate him even more, but I think there was a chance that it went the other way, you know.
And I was worried about his motivation,
right? But
this for the remainder of this season.
Yeah, with the calendar slam having gone. Yeah, but I think you're absolutely right, Alcaraz is now his motivation, and it just felt like the fact that, you know, he came out starting this tournament in Cincinnati, he'd grown his beard out, there was a sort of slightly menacing feel to him, as though he'd sort of been sort of stewing on that Wimbledon final loss. I know he said it was over in a day, I move on, but it felt like he was kind of out for revenge all tournament. And it is the most Djokovic move to bounce back immediately. I do think a couple of the results I always think of in Djokovic's career are the fact that he won Wimbledon straight after he'd lost that Roland Garros final to Stan Wawrinka, where he was, you know, devastated. He won his next tournament, and he won his next tournament after he'd lost to Medvedev in the US Open and hadn't completed the career, the calendar Grand Slam. His ability to bounce back from disappointment is something that has defined his whole career, and he's still doing it. And it was everything.
I wonder about the scenario, and look, I desperately hope, and obviously it looks very much on the cards, that we will get Djokovic against Alcaraz in the final of the US Open, because they're so much better than absolutely everybody else. That is beyond question last night. But there's a reason you play the matches. Anything can happen in sport. Imagine the scenario where Alcaraz goes out and Djokovic is still in. I can imagine that being like a balloon popped for Djokovic. He's faced him at his last three tournaments, having wanted this matchup for so long. Djokovic has now run into Alcaraz three times. He is a defining feature of this chapter of Djokovic's career. He's giving him a reason to get up in the morning, to go the extra mile. I can imagine him feeling, you know, like Nadal did when Federer retired, just a bit kind of, oh, all right, I've got to beat Casper Ruud, have I? Yeah, I don't know. I could see that being a slightly weird scenario. I'd still back him to come through it because it's Novak Djokovic, but I could see him losing a bit of an edge in that kind of scenario. I think Djokovic right at this moment is defined by Alcaraz more so than the reverse is true, because Alcaraz has got his little Jannik Sinner thing going on. He's got his, you know, the little cohort of, you know, the Rune Sinner Alcaraz thing. It's huge for Alcaraz, the Djokovic thing, but he's also got an eye on the future and what the next 10-15 years are going to look like. This is it for Djokovic. This is probably how long he can hold off Alcaraz is the final chapter of his career at the top. And it's utterly compelling. Utterly. I mean, how, other than completely shot, how must Djokovic feel this morning, having at a certain breakdown sat there with us all wondering if he would even complete the match, to in the end forcing a situation where it was Alcaraz's body that failed, because it did. Not failed to the extent that it did in Paris, but failed enough that Djokovic had the physical edge in the final stages of that match. He must feel like a king, a very old, creaky king.
Well, the word you used earlier of being feeling proud, I think, is apt, because and there wasn't just one comeback in this match. There were several, because there were several moments where both players looked done, i.e. either physically, or how can you withstand the disappointment of that and come back and be competitive? Because I was astonished by Alcaraz's comeback in that third set, for instance, when he looked done, and the break back, and then Djokovic withstanding the disappointment of that and still finding a way to win those final points. But you're right, in the end, he just about broke Alcaraz down to take that edge off him in the tie break to get over the line. One of them had to get over the line, and that's what eventually won it. And you know, Andy Roddick was making the point on Tennis Channel, you've also got to go back into the previous days of the tournament and look how much effort and energy Alcaraz had to expend in order to get to this point. But he was actually playing well in the final. I mean, this was not the Alcaraz of the rest of the tournament, and in fact the tournament before, where he just hasn't been very good. Suddenly he found it when he needed it, and he actually said, Roddick, he's encouraged about the way Alcaraz didn't cramp until 3 hours and 30 minutes following all these other matches, whereas he'd been cramping at 2 hours and 20 minutes in Paris and in other matches he's played. So he actually sees it as strides taken, and whilst a 36-year-old outlasted a 20-year-old, and this is where I come down, is Alcaraz is learning on the job, gathering experience, gathering know-how in these horrible, tight, difficult moments, and I think he's loving the window of it being Djokovic almost as much as Djokovic is loving it. I think that they are aware of what they've got here and that it ain't going to last very long. And in the end, I see it making Alcaraz better and more dominant.
Can we talk about the Alcaraz sobbing? Have we ever seen Alcaraz cry before?
No.
No.
It was really jarring, actually. Mm.
He's always happy. And even through his sobs, he managed to convert his sob into a beaming smile at one point, didn't he? It was kind of, I know it's going to be all right in the end, but right in this moment, I feel all the feelings. And it was, oh, there were so many emotions. Are we concerned about the persistent cramping of Carlos Alcaraz? I mean, some people are just more prone to cramp than others. He's got crazy muscle mass on his legs, hasn't he? Holger Rune has the same, and he's prone to cramping. Some people are just more naturally predisposed to it. That's not to say there's nothing you can do. Andy Murray went through that weird phase 12 months ago, didn't he, where he started cramping and was really disconcerted by it and made a point of just leaving no stone unturned to get on top of it as soon as he could. And he did, in fact. So maybe Carlos Alcaraz would be putting in a call to Andy Murray. But does it concern us at all?
A bit. And I think generally the sheer volume of tennis that Alcaraz had to play this week wouldn't be your absolutely ideal preparation going into US Open, even as a 20-year-old.
I don't think losing sets to Max Purcell is ever...
No, I mean...
Ever ideal.
I mean, there was a scenario where he had a chance to win that match in two sets last night, and it would have been his first straight sets win yeah. of the week. Of course, it sort of escalated and ended up being the most grueling of them all. But I suppose the Alcaraz we saw this week, and maybe a bit more last week as well, until the final, as David says, reminded me of Alcaraz from last year, where he was electric at times and the shot making was there, but it wasn't consistent and there was a lot of errors and he was losing unnecessary sets. But then, you know, he won last year's US Open without really doing anything in Canada or Cincinnati, playing a lot of grueling matches in the US Open and holding up. We saw him hold up in that Wimbledon final, which was a very long match as well, again, and stressful against Novak Djokovic. I think yesterday was really extreme. I mean, I know you can get those sticky, hot, horrible conditions in New York as well. Generally, you know, the fact, kind of as we saw yesterday, the fact that the shade came across the court eventually, and I think that helped Djokovic. I don't think of US Open finals as being sort of absolutely devastating heat. Played in the sort of back end of the day, the shade comes across. It tends to be
he's likely
all right.
to be night session a lot.
He's going to play the night
he?
Session a lot. Mm. Like, I'm not too worried, but it is a factor. It is something that he needs to manage in his career because it has cost him in a few matches now.
And that opponents will be aware of. Can I just drag this out? Can I just be John Millman against Roger Federer?
But that's the thing. Right now, the only guy who I see being able to take Alcaraz to that place is Novak Djokovic.
And at the moment, they can only meet in the final.
Yeah. Mm.
Interesting. Are we at all worried about the expenditure of yesterday? Emotional, physical, stressful, not the right word, what it takes out of either of them for the US Open. I know it's a week away and you can recover your body in a week, but they're definitely both going to have to change their planned preparation for the US Open. They're definitely not going to do the practices over the next few days that they might have been intending to do. For sure. And these are the most highly tuned athletes in the world. You know, everything is planned down to the 1%. So a disruption like that, it isn't nothing, I don't think. And I feel like it's bigger for Alcaraz because Djokovic has been doing more days off and being less rigid, I think, with the volume that he practices, sort of listening more to his body, which is what you have to do as you age, right? Whereas I don't think that comes very naturally to Alcaraz as a 20-year-old beast to go, oh, my body hurts a bit today. I think I'll have a day off from the practice court. I don't know. What do you think? Is it? Am I being silly because it's all a week away?
No, you're not. I would say that when you were talking earlier about what a balloon-popping moment it would be if they didn't meet in the final now. I mean, that really is the case. This feels like Nadal and Federer avoiding each other all those years at the US Open.
Do you think New York are really anxious that they'll end up being the slam that doesn't get
Alcaraz Djokovic? They want this. This is, and the window is so small because Djokovic is a freak, but he is 36. He can't do this for 5 years. He can maybe do it for two, I don't know, maybe three, who knows. But I just feel like if they've woken up this morning all right, I think they'll be okay, but I do feel like they pushed each other to levels and extremes that are not normal last night. And if anything was going to break, it could have been in that match. If one of their hamstrings was going to pop or something was going to go. The reason I think they'll be okay is Djokovic is a past master at managing these situations. If he wakes up okay today, he will just manage his body for the next 3 weeks to get to that final. Alcaraz, he doesn't need to do as much, but there is a premium on the experience of people like Ferrero now to hold him back, to tell him to stand down, to recover. Because he can. He can afford... I don't know the exact requirements physiologically in a situation like this and sports science-wise. I'm sure there are cooling down things that they should do to reduce lactic acid and all these sort of things. But I would have thought... I mean, Alcaraz can afford to take however many days off he needs in order to recover. There are enough there. And then because it's a match every other day, you get that time to pace yourselves. I think what's happening to Alcaraz in the last 3 months, including the French Open, is he is fast-tracking his development in Grand Slams and in big matches because he's being forced to. He's having to play Novak Djokovic at the sharp end in the most stressful situations imaginable. And it's like when players say, I have to go and practice at tournaments against top players because that's how I improve. Alcaraz is doing it on the job, and I just feel like he's probably now going to go through the US Open draw against the people he should beat easily. He'll beat them easily. I think that they both will. They'll have moments, I'm sure, where players play well against them. I bet you they cruise the first week.
Yeah, I think so too. And there's a couple of things about... this is kind of taking the final aside, but on the fact that Alcaraz didn't really play well all week, I don't think Cincinnati suits him very well. There's a very... It seems to me, I've only been to the event once and I mostly remember the roller coasters. but it seems to me that it's very high bouncing, whether that's the balls or the surface or an interaction thereof. The drop shot certainly...
It's a waste of time.
He put the drop shot away. Yeah, he put the drop shot away mostly, didn't he? And that's a huge weapon of his. During a lot of those grueling rallies when... Alcaraz was clearly on the brink of cramp with his legs, and you know his first serve just deserted him for most of the third set, didn't he? Because I don't think he had the necessary explosivity in his legs to get up on it. He was right on the edge, and yet still he wasn't serve and volleying at all. I mean, he was occasionally at the net, but it had to be a darn brilliant volley to win the point. And look, he's capable of darn brilliant volleys. He did it on occasion, but a lot of his powers there were blunted by the conditions in Cincinnati. And I do think it's different. It's quicker in New York. It's more Washington. Like, I'm sure Alcaraz would have thrived in Washington. Sorry, Dan Evans and Solly Hull. had he played there, and that's really not to take anything away from Djokovic. I'm not really talking about that match there. I'm talking about the week as a whole and the fact that he never really reached his peak until that final and was dropping sets against players that you would never usually expect him to drop sets to. Who's the favourite for the US Open, chaps? You knew this was coming. Don't look so indignant about the question.
I mean, this is going to sound like a total cop-out, but I feel like it is possible that the answer is sort of equal. I mean, how can you call one over the other right now?
I genuinely did just choke on my coffee, unrelated.
You were just so disgraced with my answer, you just choked on your coffee. I mean... I genuinely think you can build an equal case for both.
You absolutely can. I'm asking if you had to endorse one.
Right now, I would be picking Alcaraz.
David.
Same. I would also say Alcaraz because I feel like he's got everything he needs from the past 2 weeks. I think it's been a lot harder than he would have expected. Certainly harder than I would have expected. I didn't see all those three-set matches come in. But I just don't think normal rules apply to this guy. I don't there are so many moments where normally I would think, oh, that's going to get in his head now, not to have won from a set and a break up. That's standard practice, isn't it? But I just don't think it applies to this guy. I think he takes it as experience so quickly in a positive way and turns it around the way he did when he cramped at the French Open. I would never have believed that somebody could come back after cramping at the French Open and just put it behind them like that. And I think that that body is a, if he can handle the cramping, I do think, Catherine, you're asking, is it an issue? I do think it's a concern for him and his fans and his support team in the short term. I think in 2 years' time, we'll wonder, we'll remember when Alcaraz used to cramp. But at the moment, it is still a concern because it may be that Djokovic might find his best chances dragging him into 5 hours and then inducing cramp to take the edge off. That may be the case, but I don't see it like that. I think that at the US Open, he's already learning how to peak for Grand Slams at 20. I find that staggering. Maybe that's the most Nadal-like thing about him, that he's learned how to do it that early. And I think he will be better at the US Open even than he was in this final. And I think he'll win the US Open.
Yeah.
Well, more stock David on thinks he's winning the next 12 slams.
That's true. So yeah, he really needs to
if
win
you
would, the US
if
Open.
If you had backed out on that at the next slam, David, we'd be taking you to task.
Quite right.
I think I just put more stock on what happened at Wimbledon. You know, he beat Djokovic over 5 on grass.
Yeah.
Like, that was unbelievable what he did that day. We've seen him be able to do that. So, you know, yesterday felt like Djokovic getting a bit of revenge, getting a bit of an edge that he needed. Absolutely. But it doesn't take away from what Alcaraz did at Wimbledon. I'd said it again, didn't I? At Wimbledon. But
it's in your muscle memory now.
It is. Really need to work on that.
Did either of you have a favourite second or moment of the match, like favourite shot? Because there were so many. I was just thinking back to the Djokovic backhand pass at the 5-all game in the third set.
Oh, yeah.
When Alcaraz hit the perfect forehand volley onto the light, like played the perfect point, the sort of point that Federer might have played against him, and he conjured that backhand pass out of nowhere. Like, both players playing their best stuff in that game, same time. Colin Fleming on commentary said he thinks it might be the best game he's ever seen.
I mean, Alcaraz saved a match point with a 98 mile an hour forehand. That was pretty cool. He saved another match point running down a Novak Djokovic sort of drop volley
sort of
bunted it up the line in a gap that didn't really exist.
Punt down the line, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
that Djokovic sort of left because he thought, "Well, that's not possible. Yeah.
I've been playing this sport for 20 years. Nobody's made that pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. It's the way that they're both able to push each other to limits that no one else at the moment can. And they so often each respond to that with just sheer brilliance that no one else can find either. They just extract. It's such a push and pull. They push each other to the limit, and then the guy responds with something even better. It's absolutely tantalising. And honestly, there are 128 men in that US Open draw. There is one match I need to see. I want to see. You know,
Kasper Ruud against Hubert Hurkacz.
The Mathurin Derby.
There'll be good stuff along the way, but if we don't get Alcaraz Djokovic, I will feel a bit cheated.
Oh yeah, I think
it kind of reminds me
that is
of like
sort of an objective way for tennis fans to feel now. Right? If you're not all about Djokovic Alcaraz in the men's, then what are you doing?
It's when I go back and read about how, you know, in the sort of days before pro tennis, people used to turn pro and just go on tour together and play like 50 matches against each other. Almost feels like Alcaraz and Djokovic could could just do that now.
Like Casper Ruud and Nadal did in South America in December.
You've brought up Casper Ruud again.
Ruining the first half of Casper Ruud's season.
Yeah, but the interest is just there. Now, obviously, you know, I don't want them to do that. I want them to be playing in the biggest and best tournaments. That's part of what makes their matches so good. Of course it is. But they're just on a different plane at the moment. And the fact that they're at such different stages of their career is making the rivalry so fascinating. You know, like, I would love to have 10 or 15 years of Alcaraz Djokovic, but
it
you
would
feel
get
different
that, right now.
Exactly. You wouldn't get the utter sweet spot that we're in now. Start of career, end of career, trying to reach that level, trying to fend him off. You know, it's just absolutely tantalising right now.
That is, I don't know if this is translating through the screen, but he's almost vibrating. David,
but that's an appropriate
wearing
reaction.
I might point out, and this will be this visual content will be available on our socials, but Matt is in head to toe Wilson.
Yep. of course
it's so good.
That's what you do, isn't
he
it?
He looks like, you know how tennis players and I'm sure other athletes on the brink of a big tournament, they're invited to their sponsor's like flagship store. And they're informed, everything in here is already in your size. Just pick whatever you want. There's a car waiting to carry only merchandise. You just pick out whatever you want, Matthew. And that's. It looks like that's what Matt's done.
I'm on my way, Wilson. Let me know where your event is.
You don't need any more stuff. You've got a whole wardrobe.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Right. Well, do you know what? If Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz need advice on how to cope with the most grueling sporting conditions imaginable, I reckon they should call Coco Gauff, because she was the only person yesterday whose performance didn't seem to be affected by the conditions. Her opponent definitely was, Karolina Muchova, and I think lots else affected her. Well, she told us lots else affected her performance yesterday in the final. But I realised after watching the men's final that actually Coco Gauff and Karolina Muchova had played in worse conditions. They'd played in the absolute peak heat and burning sun of the day. And it just wasn't really mentioned in relation to Coco Gauff. She and I know she tells us that about herself. She says the hotter the better, but until you've really seen her just power through like it's a nice 21 degree spring day in Paris or something, it's kind of hard to process. But wow, how has Coco Gauff transformed herself since losing in the first round of Wimbledon? And I don't mean that in terms of her being a different player or necessarily doing loads of things differently. But something has shifted, and I think of her differently now. I think of her going into this US Open differently than I ever have before.
Yeah, I think so. I think that what she has achieved is astonishing, really, in the space of a 2-3 month turnaround. And if you consider that it's been a long time of stagnation, really, from... I know she reached the French Open, so it's probably since then, but there's certainly not been any strides taken since that French Open final in a positive sense that I've been able to detect until that Washington win. In fact, I feel like she's gone backwards. I found her interview on court so revealing, and she let us in, and we've seen the tears after hurtful losses in the past, but she's such a positive talker outwardly that that's her way of dealing with it, I think, is to move forwards. But in that interview on the court, she said, you know, I've been on my own so many times crying in the middle of the night because I don't know what to do. I'm trying to find the answers, and now she's found the answers. And to win Washington, biggest tournament of her career to date, to beat Iga Świątek, I mean, to go toe-to-toe with Iga, who, okay, I'm sure her fans would say, well, Iga wasn't at her best. Probably wasn't. But it was still a pretty good Iga Świątek, I thought. And Gauff did not break down. She did everything that Mary Carrillo says a top player needs to do. She found a way to hide that weakness of the forehand and defend it. She had the serve. She had her own weapon, and she just brought it to bear. And her weapons are multiple because she's obviously got the backhand list-worthy backhand. She's got the movement that is the best in the game. And she's also got that competitive spirit. She has as good an attitude on the court as you can have, I think. And I just think it was massive. I would just like to say one small thing about Brad Gilbert as well, who I'm wary of giving coaches too much credit because Coco Gauff is the player that deserves the credit for the win. But Brad Gilbert, I was looking this up. I remembered it, and I looked it up to make sure. He came on board with Andre Agassi in March of 1994, and 6 months later, Agassi won the US Open. He came on board with Andy Roddick in June of 2003, and 3 months later, Andy Roddick won the US Open. I don't know whether Coco Gauff's going to win the US Open, but he's had a similarly... she's had similarly transformative results as they both had. That can't be coincidence. He has an ability to communicate ideas and get people playing their best stuff. I don't think he's turned her game around and given her a new forehand, but he's helped her to get the best out of herself.
Yeah, there's enough evidence and data points there that you've just cited, David, that this is not an accident. And I feel the same trepidation that you do about giving too much credit to coaches, particularly where it's female player, male coach, but he deserves some credit. Clearly he is a huge factor here, to the extent that my brother has bought his book Winning Ugly. Yeah, I don't think 2 months ago my brother would have seen a future in which he was reading Brad Gilbert's book of the mid-90s, but here he is reading and learning.
Yeah, and I think, you know, players always deserve credit for hiring the right coach. You know, it's ultimately them that have to make that decision as well. And I think that's a really interesting word and point about stagnation, because that's been the sort of paradox of Coco Gauff's career. Like, she's still so young, and yet she's been around so long and so good for so long that this, in a way, has kind of felt like a long time coming. And yet it isn't really. She's still at the very developmental stage in her career, and she's sort of way ahead of the curve in that respect. But once you do get defined as a certain player, and once you are stagnating, it's very, very difficult to shift it and change your storyline, change your narrative, get out of it. I mean, how many players do we talk about who just sort of week in, week out do the same sort of thing? It might be a great thing. It might be, you know, constantly reaching quarterfinals or semifinals. They're really good, but they've hit a ceiling. And Coco Gauff had been, you know, a consistent top 10 player, but just had these sort of obstacles, you know, and mainly the forehand and not being able to overcome them. It felt like that had become the Coco Gauff narrative. How is she going to get out of this? And, you know, I think long term in her career, I thought maybe she would get out of it, but not in this short space of a time. And I completely agree. It's not like the forehand is totally fixed, but she's covering it up and therefore showing off all the other aspects of her game, you know. And actually now against Iga Swiatek, if she can protect that forehand, it suddenly doesn't feel like such a bad matchup, because she's able to move with Swiatek in a way that kind of no one else is. She can defend and put balls back, and she's got the grit and the resilience that you need to be able to push the world number one. And she's got a serve, which is a big weapon as well. And I don't think we can overstate what a big deal that was to beat Swiatek and get over that mental barrier. I mean, she said afterwards, didn't she, that she didn't want Galmon Fils' record against Novak Djokovic. You know, she was wary that was becoming a thing, not even winning a set, and suddenly she goes and wins the match. That in itself, even if she hadn't gone on to win the title, that in itself was just a massive, massive breakthrough. It's changed my outlook on her, because now there's no draw that I look at and think, oh, well, Coco Gauff can't get through that. You know, previously, if she was in Iga Swiatek's section, unfortunately, it's over for Coco Gauff. But now, kind of feels like anything is kind of possible for her.
It feels like Brad Gilbert has helped her to rediscover the swagger that she had as a junior. I remember Mary Carrillo telling us that as a junior, Coco Gauff was just so much physically superior to everybody, because she developed very early physically, didn't she? And in juniors, what you tend to see is somebody with the skill but still developing physically. But she was such a superior athlete as a junior that was enough. The weaknesses weren't exposed. She was able to disguise them. And then sort of gradually over the course of her senior career, again, talking about her like she's been out there forever, but, you know, it's tough out there. There's so many good players and the weaknesses get exposed, but they have the mics in the coaching boxes, don't you? So you can hear the sort of constant dialogue from the coaches. And Brad Gilbert is particularly in tight moments, I noticed, against Iga Swiatek. He kept on reminding her that she was the better athlete. Even against Iga Swiatek, who's an incredible athlete, make this physical. You're the one athletically here. Make it about that. Yes, you're not a perfect tennis player. So he wasn't shouting that. I'm reading between the lines here. You might have an issue with your forehand. Who cares? You've got other attributes that are so much better than everyone else. They can cover it up. Nobody's perfect. Iga Swiatek has a slightly ropey second serve. It's just so hard to expose because everything else is so good. That can be you. And I thought that was amazing to see. And it's so interesting when she won, suddenly all the stats about, you know, teenagers winning titles get trotted out, and I find that really jarring, because I just don't think of youth as a feature of Coco Gauff anymore. Obviously I did when she first burst on the scene all those many years ago in 2019 as a 15-year-old. But usually when you hear stats about, I think one of them was first teenager to win multiple titles in a year since Bianca Andreescu.
That's it. Andreescu in 2019 was at a completely different prospect to Gauff.
Exactly.
In 2023.
Usually teenagers doing things, what they're doing is bursting out of the blocks and taking everyone by surprise and using that sheen of youth and newness and the unknown as an opponent and using that as a weapon. Coco Gauff doesn't have any of those attributes, but she's got experience. and she's got resilience because she's experienced highs and lows, and yet she's 19, which is so bizarre, but incredible, absolutely incredible. What did we think about lovely Karolina Muchova's opening words in her speech being about how sore she felt that morning?
I woke up and said, ouch.
Yeah.
Which, unfortunately, I feel like Karolina Muchova does a lot.
Yeah, it was a sort of line where if it had come from somebody that had a reputation for being an eggy loser, I would wince at it and go, oh, that's a bit uncool. That's sort of saying, oh, you only won because I wasn't physically 100%. But because it's Karolina Muchova, you maybe give her a bit of a free pass, especially as she clearly was feeling it physically yesterday.
Yeah, and she was clutching her ab, wasn't she, against Sabalenka. Yeah. I was quite worried about that. And then the next day she comes out with a lot of strapping on her leg. It was just the Karolina Muchova story, really. But again, a demonstration that when, if she was fit this week, you know, she was fit enough to be able to play and win matches, she's up there with the best of them with her game. You know, we saw that again. The way she came back against Sabalenka, having lost that really up and down first set where they sort of both had chances to win it. When Sabalenka came through that, Muchova just ignited in sets two and three and just played at a level that kind of not even Sabalenka could really live with, which I was pretty shocked by, I suppose. Yeah, maybe wasn't the greatest thing to say first line of the speech, but I think it was just genuine.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But great to have Muchova, you know, at the sharp end of a big tournament again. She makes good matches as well because of that different style that she's got.
Okay, some big picture questions for you both to end this segment on. I'll start with Sabalenka losing in a semi-final again to Karolina Muchova. Does the fact that the semi-final hurdle is now extending beyond Grand Slams into 1,000 events, does this cement our feeling that Sabalenka, you know, that maybe one victory over Magda Linette in Australia might have been the exception and the Grand Slam semi-final problem does still linger?
I do think yes. There's a problem there. Yeah, I do. And look, she's won the Australian Open, so you kind of feel like she should be able to live off the memories of that and be able to get over this. But the evidence doesn't really suggest that. You know, she's been in these matches where I kind of feel like she should be winning. Muchova is one of my favourite players to watch because I don't know what I'm going to get from game to game, but she was inhibited, and the commentators in that Sabalenka match were saying, I really don't understand why she's playing if her abs hurting, because you know that is not an area of your body you want to be messing around with as a tennis player. And yeah, I mean, tournaments in which Elena Rybakina and Iga Swiatek fall early should, by the narrative we've all developed over the last year, mean that Arina Sabalenka picks up the pieces and goes and wins.
Oh, no.
But, I mean, you know, I do feel like this was a big opportunity that she should have taken. She should be, like, Alcaraz cramps at the French Open and gets revenge at Wimbledon. Djokovic stomachs that disappointment and goes and wins Cincinnati. Sabalenka's lost to Muchova, the French, from leading, and then goes and does it again. I think that's a problem, really. And look, it's not one she can't reverse, but she's got work to do in my eyes.
Yeah, she has changed in my mind as a player this year, Sabalenka. Absolutely, you know, she's won that slam. Her consistency across the season is something that I don't think she's really shown before. You know, she beat Jabeur here, having lost to her at Wimbledon. You know, there was some sign of, you know, a little bit of revenge there. But this is a problem, absolutely. Mm. You know, it goes back her whole career. You know, a couple of years ago, that one against Leila Fernandez, at the US Open last year against Iga Świątek at the US Open, a couple of big ones this summer. It is a problem, and she hasn't got over that. She got over it once, as you said, against Magdalena in Australia, but she hasn't completely sort of cured herself of that. I think it's absolutely something to still be wary of when we're thinking about Sabalenka as a contender at the biggest tournaments, which she is, but she's not a banker by any means because of this problem.
Okay, next question. How big's the women's mix at the US Open, and is Coco Gauff in it? Is Karolina Mukova in it? That was a lot of questions.
Good
in
questions,
one question,
though.
Wasn't
I think
it?
I think it's quite big. And I definitely think Coco Gauff's in it, 100% in it. I think that Karolina Mukova, fully fit, is in it, and that is a big if, isn't it? By the way, what she said on the court, I kind of thought it was might have even been three-pronged. She might have been also talking about the last, and this is a compliment to Coco Gauff, the last play you want to be playing in these conditions, in this heat, and if you're feeling anything, is her. Ouch. Because she's going to make you feel the pain. And then the conditions generally. But I think that she might start beating Sabalenka quite handily in the future, because she's, unless Sabalenka pulls it back, because Sabalenka's determination to dominate, at some point Mukova gets into this mindset where she's just able to completely make her malfunction. And I think, so fully fit, I would put Mukova in the mix as well.
David's more gung-ho with his mix than we are, aren't we? You're more trigger happy with your mix, which is fun.
Is Marketa Vondroušová in the mix?
Oh Christ!
No, not for me.
Oh God!
Really?
Mukova is. I would be surprised if Mukova won the U.S. Open. So she's not in my mix. She's with Jannik Sinner for me, maybe in a different kind of way. But wouldn't be surprised to see them in the final. Would be surprised to see them win it, which I know is sort of counterintuitive, because if we end up, you know, on the eve of the final doing a final preview podcast of a final with Mukova in it, I'm not going to say, well, she's got zero chance, am I? I'm going to say she's got a chance regardless of who she's playing, because she's blooming good. But that's how I feel. And we have had final mixes in the past, haven't we? David famously had a Cameron Norrie final mix at this year's Australian Open.
Years a so long time in tennis.
That's how I feel about Mukova. Coco Gauff's in the mix for me.
Yeah, for me too. I mean, I could probably extend it to about 7 or 8 names. I think Świątek, Rybakina, Sabalenka, Gauff.
Rybakina is not right.
No,
physically.
No,
in a few different ways. I feel.
Yeah, I think the shoulder is an issue. I think the general load of matches that she's had, and I think, you know, possibly still some effects of whatever she had back in the summer. She doesn't seem quite right. I agree, but not enough for me to take her out of the mix personally. I think you've then got tricky names like Jessica Pegula, has been in incredible form, but has a quarterfinal problem. Ons Jabeur, like, has reached 3 Grand Slam finals, but actually getting over and winning one is a problem. Marketa Vondroušová, Karolina Mukova. Like, there's
the eternal Kvitova problem.
No, she's not in the mix.
No, but you know, just who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, like those are my 8 names.
Okay, David, any further submissions?
See, I've gone early and said the mix is pretty big, and then I've just completely eliminated Marketa Vondroušová, who won the most recent grand. And now Matt's reading off names, and I'm thinking, yeah, you're right, she's not in it. So I don't know. I haven't been forensic enough about it. I suppose maybe there is a distinction to be made between a final mix and a tournament winning mix in how I end up looking at it. There are certain players that I wouldn't be surprised reach the final, but I still think they'd end up losing it. I'm very confident about the 4. Rybakina definitely is at the lower end of that. I think I'd probably put her behind Gauff now in terms of likelihood
Same.
To win the thing. But at the same time, I often think, well, if somebody's that good and they for whatever reason rock up and feel okay, well, they could end up still winning it all. But yeah, I'd probably put Goff at sort of joint second favorite right now for the title.
Yeah, I think I feel similarly, David. Form-wise with Rybakina, it's just the Grand Slam winning pedigree of Rybakina. Form-wise, I'm pretty worried about her, really. She seems a way off, and it's really disappointing because I'm really into the big three. Could soon be a big four or big five or big six or, you know, whatever. I'm into it, whatever it is. I'm into a cluster rivalry. Okay, well, look, we've got a whole week of US Open preview to come, so we shan't delve into mixed chat any further. I've also got some on the boat updates, having just spent a weekend with my dad and quiz Captain Whittaker on a few people and their boat status, so that's a little tease of what's to come over US Open preview week. What do we have coming up? We're recording a podcast on Thursday, David's arrival day in New York. That's draw day.
Guys, the noises about the US Open draw, I'm not liking them.
Who's making noises? Is it you?
Well, no. The reports are that it's just going to be plonked online. Not streamed, no event. And I think that happened last year. I can't quite remember because we were travelling. And I remember just seeing it online, but I think that's what happened. And that is a disgrace.
Look, USTA, it's not too late to change your mind. If you don't want to have to face the wrath of Matt Roberts, or should I say continued wrath of Matt Roberts.
What are they doing?
Why would you not make something of your draw?
Right. I mean, there's two elements. There's the transparency and, you know, people will say, oh, it's rigged or whatever. Look, I don't think the US Open draw is rigged.
That's not the reason don't do draws.
But
come on.
That is something that will be thrown at them if they don't do it publicly. But the real thing is, as David says, make something of it. It's an event in itself. It sets up the next 2 weeks. We've just listed off about eight different players that we think might win the Women's US Open. I want to know what their path is like. I want to know when they might meet. I want that hype.
You want to hear the sharp intakes of breath and the ooh-la-las and the random rugby players being brought on stage. Yeah. It's not too late to change your mind and hastily arrange some sort of ceremony, even if it's just Matt in the audience. It'll be worth it, guys, I promise. So that's coming up on Thursday.
It's going to be a great show, though.
It's going to be a great show. Do tune in. That's why I hyped up the On The Boat chat. We might need some supplement. Friday is media day. We will all be there firing questions at your favourite tennis players, and we'll be recording a show after that. For friends, we have already recorded our US Open Relived show. The Kim Clijsters story is up now for Friends of the Tennis podcast. If you want to listen to that, and though we say so ourselves, it is well worth a listen. Kim herself is so generous with her time and played such a huge part in telling her own story. That is up now for friends. If you'd like to become a friend, support the show, get access to all of our bonus content, and help us do what we do year round, you can even grab yourself a shout out or an intro. The link to do that is in our show notes. We will also be doing some live YouTube shows, picking up where we left off from Wimbledon. Watch this space for exact news of that. We did have a plan. The plan has been somewhat slightly modified by the soon-to-be latest instalment of the Matt and Catherine go on a road trip to concerts in the United States series. Which
Bruce Springsteen's health pending.
Health permitting is going to have its latest instalment on Saturday. But don't worry, folks. We will still stick to our plans for live shows, just with a slightly adjusted schedule. And watch this space for news thereof. Do follow our Instagram, our Twitter, or X. No one's calling it X, are they? No, I'm all right still calling it Twitter. Threads, pending, if that takes off, who knows? We've got an account, haven't done any posts, but it's, you know, again, watch this space. We have a mascot for this episode. That mascot is Quincy. And Quincy is owned by Kate Darling. Kate, what an amazing name you have. Quincy is a Shih Tzu Cavalier King Charles Spaniel mix, which I believe in some quarters is known as a Cavasu. And Quincy has a wee bit of a Billie Jean flavour about him, wouldn't you say, Matt?
Definitely.
I mean, Billie Jean is also half
similar,
Cavalier King Charles
colouring.
Spaniel. Yeah, and I'd say probably similar sizing. In fact, Billie Jean is sometimes mistaken for a Shih Tzu cross because she is so tiny. Kate says Quincy's very old. He doesn't look it. He looks in his prime, Kate. So thank you very much for making Quincy a mascot and for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast. We have our mascots. David's got Maisie. I've got Xenia and Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And Matt, we have special Heathrow Airport shout-outs.
I mean, I must say, I feel like David deserves a shout-out for not bringing up his Coco Gauff to win the title prediction in this episode. That was incredible restraint, David. Impressed.
Those lurkers at casinos that watch when people are on slot machines and have put a load of money in and failed to win, and then they swoop in and clean up the jackpot. That's David Law this week. And I was the mug last week that put all the cash in the machine.
Not only am I not taking credit, I'm actually getting hammered for it.
Yep.
I'd actually clean.
There's a skill to lurking, David. There's a skill to it.
You'd forgotten about it. Yeah, right.
Who are our actual shout-outs for? David hasn't paid any money
for
that.
Our actual shout-outs are Catherine Willerton.
Oh, hello, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine.
Same church, same pew.
Same church, same pew.
Catherine is from Southport. It says, a long-time listener to the pod from Southport in Merseyside, which isn't a hotbed of tennis talent, so it's great to see Neil Skupski doing so well.
Well, and Ken Skupski. Actually, I would call two brothers. I mean, that is a bit of a... Does that not count as a hotbed?
Yeah, maybe it does, actually.
I was going to say, it's more than Putney's ever produced, but Putney, of course, produced Joe Salisbury. Although he's moved, I think. But anyway. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've also got Nick Orrett, who is in Melbourne.
Hello, Nick.
Right, Nick.
Yeah, I've been looking at Melbourne accommodation this week. Planning a couple of slams ahead. Yeah. I'm anticipating the post-US Open come down and it will be eased by Melbourne planning.
Good thinking.
Do we know anything about Nick?
Nick was born in Kent but moved to Australia with his family aged 11.
Oh, classic.
He discovered the podcast in 2020 while working as a junior doctor in Victoria during the pandemic.
Amazing work, Nick. I wonder if Nick still has a remnant of a British accent. Let us know, Nick.
I wonder if Nick looks out for fellow tennis Nicks whilst, you know, watching tennis and has any liking for Nick Kyrgios, who, by the way, is not playing the US Open and has only played one match all year, I think, hasn't he? Do you ever look out for players bearing your name and sort of slightly...
I wouldn't if my name is the same as Nick Kyrgios's.
Right. Okay. My son does. If my son sees anybody with his name in football or tennis, that's the one he's going to support.
That doesn't surprise me.
Thank you, Nick.
And finally, we have Avrilina Madella.
Wowza. Love that.
Who is originally from Cyprus, but currently based in both Belgium and the Netherlands.
Wow.
Okay.
Home of
I hope, Avrilina, you enjoyed the Kim Clijsters story.
Yep. Hopefully.
course you did.
I mean, I obviously don't know any Avrilinas or any tennis Avrilinas. You are a one-off in our parts, Avrilina, but I am going to say Avril Lavigne because it sounds a little bit like that.
Yes.
And she had some bangers. I mean, she's still going. She might still be producing bangers that I'm not aware of. But back in the day, Avril Lavigne really did have some bangers. So thank you, Avrilina. And thank you for listening. Thank you to all of our friends of the show that are making it possible for us in an hour and 19 minutes' time, provided everything is on time, for Matt and I to jet off to New York, for David to follow us on Thursday, and for us to start producing US Open 2023 podcasts. If it is not clear, folks, we are pumped. So we'll speak to you from New York on Thursday.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.